So this week on The Encrypted Economy, we have Ruben Brahmanathan on the episode. He is an attorney who now wears lots of hats in the digital asset ecosystem. He is currently actively engaged as an investor in Idea Colab Ventures. Ruben's articles caught my attention because he is particularly thoughtful around the concept of social tokens. And this is where the lines between NFTs and communities often get blurred, but it's also where the future of communities are likely to lie. First, what is an NFT or non-fungible token? Simply put, it's a process to assign something a distinct identifier that lives on a public blockchain. That's sort of it. From there, you can do all sorts of things with what that identifier relates to, and that identifier is essentially your certificate of authority. For an artist or a sports figure, it's the autograph that is certified to be genuine. For the piece of artwork, it is the proof that it's the original, or at least for that copy. For example, the Mona Lisa is copied all over the place, but there can only be one original. But let's not get hung up here. Ruben has great understanding of what you can do with that certificate, that proof, and sees it more than an asset to be traded, but as something that is meaningful and brings a unique experience or engagement to its holder. Think of special personalized passcode or token that is bought by a user that allows them to engage directly with an artist, sports figure, personality, etc., and a larger community associated with them. Where there is unique interaction within that community and perhaps associated benefits, perhaps even governance. I know you're thinking, governance? Yes, think of fans actually being able to participate in decisions relating to a brand or personality. Simple example, a social token might allow the holders to vote on what the next song of an artist should be called. Let's say that song becomes a sensation and your token is associated with its naming. That could really connect you with the artist and also have real value to others as well. Think of all the different permutations. What it really is a different engagement model, and we touch on that in this episode. So I bring you my interview with Ruben, and as always, if you like what you're hearing, please like it, share it. Thanks so much. Welcome to The Encrypted Economy, where we look at the business of regulation and security for all things encrypted, digital assets, blockchain technology, privacy, and smart contracts. Hope you'll join us while we explore these forces that are shaping the economy. So this is Eric Hess with The Encrypted Economy, and I'm really excited to have Ruben Brahmanathan on the show with me. Ruben has a fascinating background. A lot of people listening might have read his works on Medium, talking about NFTs and elsewhere. He's certainly been very active in the space. Until about 2019, he spent a number of years at Coinbase, which seems to be sort of the launching off ground for a lot of people who are now moving into other projects in the crypto space. But I'm not going to tell a story because it's going to be very interesting to hear him tell it himself. But Ruben, thanks so much for joining us on the show.
Thank you, Eric. Great to chat.
Excellent. So you are a lawyer. What interested you primarily in law?
Yeah, going way back, I decided to get into law almost like a default option. You know, my first interest was actually in technology. I grew up, you know, building computers and networking and having LAN parties and just all that nerdy stuff around computers and the internet. But when it was time for me to choose a career, it was just after the dot-com crash and everyone told me, no, Ruben, the internet is over. Go and get a real job. So I went and studied law and economics and kind of went down that pathway. But it didn't take me too long to realize that technology is my passion.
And so from traditional law, what was your path to Coinbase?
Yeah, I got interested in Bitcoin through some friends around 2012. I think a lot of people have a similar story. They had some friends who were really into it. They started learning more. I just became more and more curious. And that was my story as well. And then I started to think about it from the perspective of a lawyer, because I started to think about, what is this thing? Is it money? Is it property? What are the legal implications? How is it going to work internationally? And I started to realize that no one had these answers. So as I started researching more, I started to read and write more, was involved in 2014 with a project to change the tax law in Australia to actually fix the way that tax would apply to Bitcoin transactions. And then through that, just kind of realized that, look, this is something I want to spend my career doing. And it's been a wild ride since then.
Yeah, well, you didn't get stuck in the tax law. The tax law, you could probably spend your entire career as it relates to crypto. That's an unraveling story legally. So how did you come to decide to join Coinbase? I mean, was it targeted? Did you know people there? What was that like?
That was just part of my journey wanting to get into crypto full time. Or I guess back then it was just Bitcoin. So it was 2015, Coinbase was hiring. So I decided to move from Australia to San Francisco, joined there as one of the first lawyers at Coinbase. To me, that was just a great opportunity and a young company with a lot of amazing people there. And yeah, it was a no-brainer.
Excellent. So you spent a few years at Coinbase. You were in a project management role as well as, I guess, an attorney role. Were your legal skills brought to bear in product design?
Yeah. So we, you know, did a lot of work early on around the regulation of crypto trading, both in the US and internationally. So that was my role, really, as a product counsel, working closely with product managers and engineers, looking at that product roadmap, which customers can we serve, where, what products, what requirements do we need to have in place, what licenses do we need to get. So doing all of that, I ended up working really closely with those product teams. Through that, realized, look, you know, crypto is my passion. Law was just a set of tools that I had at that stage. And, you know, as I got closer to the people building the tech, I realized, look, this is where you have to be. When you spend your time with those folks, the builders, that's when you really learn about the technology. So for me, transitioning into a product management role was also just the next step on that journey.
And now you've moved on. You left Coinbase in 2019 to strike out on your own in a couple of different roles. Why don't you bring us up to the current roles? Because there's a few of them. Be interested to hear about it.
Sure, there are a few. And I think that's not uncommon these days in crypto, right? People are wearing a bunch of different hats, participating in different communities, working with different groups. And that's really empowering, honestly. It can be kind of exhausting too. But for me, so after I left Coinbase, I helped out with a bunch of early stage companies as a consultant and advisor, mainly in the DeFi space, but also some new layer one protocols, centralized exchanges, and pretty broad cross-section. So through that consulting and advising, I worked with teams like DYDX and Open, and more recently, the team at Zora. I've been working really closely with them since the beginning. And then, I started an initiative called Fair Launch Capital to get funding to DeFi projects that didn't want to raise for investors and wanted to be community owned. And so through that, I met the team at IDEO CoLab Ventures, worked with them really closely, and recently joined as an investor at IDEO. So still wearing a few hats, but the main focus is still, you know, working with teams at the earliest stage, working with entrepreneurs, teams as small as one or two or three people. Let's get something off the ground. Let's work out how to build.
Exciting time. So I don't know if you've already shared the question I typically ask guests on the show, which is a personal event that shaped your values, your worldview, or career view.
Eric, I knew there was something I was supposed to prepare. Yeah, that's a tricky one. I think it's tough to find a unique one for me. I think, you know,
Your homework. We're going to end the show right here. Sorry.
Yeah, I just cut your losses right now, Eric. I'm a dud guest. You just put this one on the cutting room floor. Well, okay, at the risk of being too cliche, and I'm sure a lot of people would say this, but it was the financial crisis in 2008 and 2009, and the repercussions of that. I was a young lawyer, and I saw colleagues getting cut, getting fired. I saw the whole economy, you know, the downturn. And just realizing, like, the economy is just a set of rules that have been built up on in this system over centuries that are very arbitrary, that reinforce existing power structures, and that ultimately don't work for everyone. And so, you know, why can't we fix that? Why can't we change that?
That's great. So it's a great launching point for getting into certainly one of the topics we want to talk about today, which is NFT, something that you've written a lot about for the listeners. NFTs is non-fungible tokens. They can't be interchanged for one another. They're not like currency. They're not like equities. Each one is arguably unique or unique within a series. But why don't you describe it? The NFTs, the different types of NFTs that you see, and why are they getting so much traction now?
So the way I like to think about NFTs and tokens generally is the beauty of a blockchain, of cryptocurrency, is you can create a token that's anything that you can imagine. The only hard part is getting others to imagine it as well, so that the technology enables this almost unlimited creation. And you can create things that are, you know, different rights, they have different utility, they have different values, revenue streams, any combination or permutation of these things. then really what you're saying is by creating this token, you're making some kind of promise to the holder of the token that you're going to deliver that value. And the traditional form of tokens, of course, are protocol tokens, or more recently in DeFi, we call them governance tokens, which give you some voting rights, they give you some upside in the project. They might have inherent value, they might not. They might derive value from scarcity like Bitcoin's digital gold status. They might be able to be used for things like paying gas and Ethereum. So traditionally, these are the ways that people thought about crypto tokens. NFTs changed that a little bit. And the reason for that is that NFTs typically represent something that has value in and of itself. So the NFT being unique has value derived from, you know, the thing behind it. And in this case, we're talking a lot about art, we're talking about design, we're talking about culture, music, anything like that. So that token is different from a token that is fungible, because those tokens are valuable only collectively by the set of rights, obligations, value that they represent. So that's the big paradigm shift here. And NFTs represent a unique, one-off, independent item.
And you actually did an experiment. You did a social token experiment. So, you know, a lot of people who are familiar with NFTs, they think they've certainly heard of art. Almost everybody, well, maybe I'm making an assumption, but a lot of people know about Top Shots and what they're doing there and how profitable that venture has been. So you see this, you know, a lot of interest being focused on sports and musical artists and painters and digital artwork. But then there's social tokens, which maybe isn't getting the same kind of traction right now. But I think you have a view on that maybe it's going to be something that sort of continues to build in the future.
Yeah, I think so. Social tokens have a long history in crypto, but it's still relatively underdeveloped, at least in terms of awareness and infrastructure. Everything's been focused on NFTs in the last 6 months or so. But social tokens and DAOs more broadly, I think, are really the transformative property of crypto, because they really enable people to coordinate and collaborate in new ways. So you can think of DAO shares, personal tokens, social tokens. These are ways for communities to come together. These are the digital equivalent and improvement on a joint stock corporation or any kind of existing legal structure. And we can go into a bunch of reasons why that it's an improvement, but I think that's quite transformative. NFTs are also transformative, but in their own way. They represent, you know, like we were talking about art or collectibles or some kind of product, right? The NFTs are the product that's being produced. The social tokens or the DAOs are the people that are producing those things. So if we zoom right out and think about blockchains as a way to enable better human coordination, then social tokens or DAOs are more directly related to achieving that goal. And NFTs are more like the digitization of real world commodities or digital commodities, right? And maybe commodities is the wrong word here. Content is probably better. So the idea that you can have a purely digital original, that's the NFT. That's another form of content, another form of product or work output. And I think that the two are going to play together.
And so you actually did an experiment where you created your own social token, the Rubin token. What was it called?
Yeah, that's right. You did ask me about
that. Do you have a name for it?
My token's called Council. I released it about a year ago. Okay. And it's a token that's redeemable for 1 hour of my time as a consultant. And it was an experiment to see, okay, well, would people buy this thing? You know, does it have any value? And I thought a lot about some of the different ways to approach that. And there have been people before and since that have done, you know, much more ambitious things. There are guys called Alex and Kerman that have released tokens with those names that I really like a share in themselves and an upside. And those tokens financially have done really well because they enable speculation. For me, being a little more conservative, I just wanted to let people basically pre-purchase my time. And I ran that experiment, launched a token. Yeah, a few people bought it. I had a bunch of new clients, you know, introductions through that. And ultimately, I think that experiment wasn't like a runaway success, but I think it was on the pathway of things that are going to enable people to, you know, build personal tokens and social tokens more broadly. I think one thing we learned in 2020 is that personal tokens are probably not as powerful as social tokens. And again, because what crypto represents is this ability to create open collaboration on the internet rather than, you know, just a pure individual enterprise.
Interesting. So yours was, I guess you would call it a personal token because it was redeemable for an hour of your time.
That's right.
And so how did you go about minting your personal token? What was that process like?
Yeah, it's actually not too difficult. And now there are a bunch of great tools that'll let you mint those tokens without any technical knowledge. But actually, Council was the first token that was minted by Zora. And at that time, you know, we were playing around with social tokens. We were playing around with real world physical tokenized goods before Zora protocol shifted to focus on NFTs. So the team there helped me to deploy that ERC20 contract. Then I took some ETH and Council and put it into a Uniswap pool and let anyone buy them. And the redemption was just and is just, you know, sending it to my address. And then once I verified that, we'll set up a time to have a chat. And yeah, it's been interesting.
And is this still out there? Are people still Council token holders?
There are still Council token holders. The amount of new inbound or new holders that actually buy it to use it went through a bit of a lull, but actually has just picked up again recently. So I've got to get back to a couple of people who I know have redeemed the token. So yeah, it's been interesting.
And unintentionally, we're now promoting it on this podcast. So maybe you'll get some more.
Yeah, this is not investment advice. I mean, if you want to chat, that's a good reason to buy it. I wouldn't put this as a cornerstone of your portfolio.
So you're not saying that the Council token is mooning?
No, sadly, no. It's not even stratospheric.
There you go. Let's differentiate personal tokens from social tokens. So there's been a lot of talk even recently about the Jack Dorsey tweet. But that's more of an NFT than a social token per se. But do you want to talk a little bit about the concept of a social token and how it differentiates from a personal token?
Yeah, a social token broadly represents the collective of a group of people, right? It could be a small online community that's in a chat room. It could be, you know, a real world organization like a sports team or a recording artist or any kind of group of people. And there's varying different flavors. So you could have a purely organic community where everyone's, you know, roughly equal in terms of their participation. That's one aspect of a social or community token. And the other one, which we're seeing more and more of, is communities centered around artists or creators. And so in that relationship, it's a little different because traditionally that artist or creator is the one who's producing the content and then the fans are the one who are consuming the content. But what I think crypto and social tokens enable is kind of a redefining of that relationship, or at least acknowledging that it is a form of community. It's not just a creator and fans. It's the fans actually, you know, add a lot of value to the creator, and that creator wouldn't exist without their community of fans. So one example is RAC, right? Grammy Award-winning artist that we helped to launch his own social token. And in doing so, we actually gave away a lot of those tokens for free to anyone who had supported his music in the past, anyone who had bought merch or supported him on Patreon. We distributed tokens to them with the idea being that, okay, now we have a community of thousands of engaged supporters. And through that, we can kind of build a mutually beneficial little mini economy around the project.
So like they would have their own forum for participation and they would get maybe exclusive access to events.
Exactly right. Yeah. There's access to exclusive content. There is participation in members only chats and the Discord. There'll be the ability to access unique NFTs or drops or other content. And then kind of zooming out a little and fast forwarding a bit, you can imagine a world where the actual content that's produced by RAC is itself tokenized in the form of an NFT. And that value can then flow back on chain programmatically to the token holders. So we're not in a world where that's possible right now. There's a few regulatory hairs on that as well, as you might imagine, but you can see that that's where this is all heading. So instead of having the fans just be fans, they actually kind of own a share of the project. And there'll be other ways for them to contribute as well. If they want to create some content of their own that can collaborate with the artist, that might be kind of woven into the mix as well. And so the boundary between content creator and consumer is going to be blurred. And that's going to be pretty profound, I think, for the way that a lot of stuff gets created on the internet.
And do you think social tokens are going to lend themselves to speculation the same way that NFTs have? Or do you think it's going to be just much more of a personal participation choice and more, maybe more like something that's a collectible within the community versus, you know,
Yeah, I think speculation is a pretty important use case of social tokens. You can imagine a spectrum where at one end, it's purely like a collectible, like a badge, something you can flex to say, I'm a supporter of this person. I've got the sticker. I voted, like whatever. That's kind of interesting. I think at the other end of the spectrum is a purely financial use case, which is maybe, okay, I'm just going to buy this token because I think it's going to moon. But somewhere in the middle, there's a whole lot of unexplored ground where your token ownership represents your membership of the community, your ability to contribute value to the community, and to be rewarded for that contribution. So you share a little bit in the financial upside, you have some skin in the game, you have some like community membership benefit as well. Where that gets challenging is when you introduce these value flow and value capture mechanisms into a community, you know, you can kind of disrupt that community because organic communities are not typically formed around exchange of value. There's much more to it. There's the creation, there's the human connection and everything like that. So that's a big risk for social token creators, is really disrupting the dynamics of the community if they get the incentives wrong.
Right. Ultimately, you want an engaged community. If you make it too monetary, you potentially just push those, you know, the people who are most engaged away. But exactly. Yet it's still, it could be very effective in sort of building a fan base and creating that artist or community experience that maybe you don't otherwise have.
Totally. Yep.
And so you talked about social tokens in the context of a community and DAOs, so decentralized autonomous organizations. I mean, DAOs these days are often used to refer to governance mechanisms. Do you see social tokens being sort of suited to a decentralized autonomous organization?
Yeah, there's a wide range of things that can be called a DAO and a wide range of things that a DAO can do. And ultimately, I think social tokens can fill a lot of that use case. So I think that maybe one analogy is like a DAO is like a private company and social tokens are like a public company. But that line's blurred again because you're going to have massive DAOs with hundreds of thousands of members. But I think ultimately they're achieving the same thing, right? They're giving people a way to align incentives across a group of people. They're giving all of those people the ability to have a voice into what the organization does and receive value and share that value. So DAOs do that through a variety of different frameworks, and social tokens have the ability to do that as well. So ultimately, I think they're just two sides of the same coin.
Interesting. So, and as we shift maybe back to NFTs a little bit, NFTs raise obviously different issues and concerns than a social token. There, you know, potentially there certainly is more speculation because in many cases it's a thing. It could be art, just like traditional art or sports figure. As you look at as you compare and contrast the NFT to the social token space, I mean, obviously there's a number of different legal issues in each. Certainly, I'd argue that there's probably more with regards to the NFTs. But what's your viewpoint on that? Like, where do you see some of the critical distinctions, particularly from a lawyer's perspective?
I think that there actually should be fewer legal issues around NFTs than around social tokens. So let's take social tokens first. I think the main and probably the only significant issue around those is securities law. Because obviously, if you're issuing a crypto token and you're selling it to the public, or at least you look at the factors of the Howey test and kind of think about whether that thing could be a security, right? And you know, there's been ad nauseum analysis done on crypto tokens and then the Howey test. But I wrote a piece recently around social tokens and securities law implications. And again, not to dive too deeply into that, but there is a spectrum where if it is a purely speculative use case, that's more likely to be a security. If it really is more a community-driven representation of that community and the participants aren't, you know, investing with the expectation of profits, that you might have a better argument there. So anyway, putting aside social tokens, which we can dive back into a little more if you like, I think the key issue for NFTs, which people have been alluding to in the last few weeks, last couple of months on Twitter, but no one's really kind of dived into deep, is the intellectual property issues. And the reason for that is artists want to know, like, what rights are they giving up? What rights are they selling? You know, if I'm minting an NFT, am I giving up the worldwide perpetual copyright in the content? Am I granting the holder a license? Is that license only in the digital realm? Can they use that in the physical realm as well to, you know, print the NFT onto a t-shirt, for example? So a lot of these questions are actually, they're causing creators some angst. And I think that there's a huge issue to be solved here. And the other side of NFTs, and I know you've been thinking about this, Eric, the securities law implications, I kind of see them as less relevant, only simply because just thinking about the Howey test, you know, the people do speculate on them for sure. But my take is that the expectation of profit from an NFT is really derived from the value of that NFT, the future demand for that piece of content, rather than the efforts of anyone else. But yeah, what do you think about that?
Certainly, this is not legal advice and not to be relied on as legal advice. But when you start to apply the Howey test and you look at some of the SEC's past actions around it, you're seeing them looking at either this notion of a network, which is relying on the managerial efforts of others, and you know that there's an expectation of profit that's been built into the sale. Some of the earlier cases, they were just flat out issuances. Some of the later ones in 2020 related to something known as a simple agreement for future tokens, which is something that nobody really does anymore in the US or tries to avoid because it raises issues. You know, they focus more on decentralization now. I mean, I guess there's still STOs and obviously and the like, but people are much more careful and not using the structure that they did in 2017-18 with regards to the ICOs. But when you look at the NFT, you're correct. You're basically looking at a product. Like if you think about baseball cards, even if Topps said you can make a ton of money on it, are we really going to extend a securities laws analysis to an actual product where people are knowing that they're purchasing a product? And if a brand goes south, who cares, right? Nobody's going to say, oh, I'm going to sue the brand or the artist or the creator because they did something terrible and now it's worth less. Those aren't the management efforts that you focus on in a securities law analysis. So the more I look at it, a lot of the issues that securities law analysis relating to transparency and disclosure, they don't actually completely disappear if you determine that they're not a security. And that's the thing. It's like people say, oh, well, it should be regulated. Well, because it's speculative. But just because something's speculative doesn't mean that it's a security. You could say it looks a lot like, but is it really, right? As you look at this thing, you say, well, there's other laws for it. There's consumer protection laws. There's gambling laws. You have all the issues of fraud and transparency and disclosure. You see that in the trading card cases, some of them which are emerging, where there's been investigations into the practices of some distributors and authenticators and the like. So there is a legal system in the United States that can handle NFTs, and it's not the one that's driven by Gary Gensler. And I really don't think that as a chairman of the SEC, he's going to say, you know what, we really got to stamp out this speculative froth around this product, right? So that's my view.
Yeah, no, well said. Yeah, totally agree. And to some extent, we're kind of shadow boxing here because there's not really any strong push or implication that this is going to be regulated as securities. But it's an interesting thing to analyze. And I totally agree. The regime that the securities law is not intended to protect against this sort of stuff, like you say. And, you know, even within the technology of NFTs, there are some mitigations against some of those risks anyway, like fraud and disclosure around the product and non-delivery. All these things are actually addressed because when you're buying an NFT, you can see exactly what the product is and you know that's exactly what you're going to get. And then because of the way most of these NFTs are sold through smart contracts, the delivery occurs instantly and programmatically as soon as you make payment. So those things actually protect the consumer in a new way as well that, you know, even traditional collectibles don't have going for them. And, you know, not to nerd out too much with apologies to non-legal listeners, I think there's another element of the Howey test that's interesting as well, which is commonality, right? Horizontal and vertical commonality, which means that if the investors collectively as a whole have a shared interest, they basically have the same upside and downside. And if the promoters or managers have the same upside and downside as the investors, you need to have one of those two things. So that has been taken for granted in every crypto token, right? All the tokens are the same. There's the same upside and downside for everyone. That is not the case for NFTs. The holder of the NFT, even in a series of NFTs, has different upside and downside, right? Let's take CryptoPunks as an example. Even if you said, okay, the CryptoPunks creators have some managerial efforts, you know, they're going to build some more stuff that's going to make the punks more valuable. That is not the same for every holder. They're all unique. So I think there's some pretty strong arguments about why NFTs and even like series of collectible NFTs should not be securities.
Yeah, for sure. I think one of the things that we are going to struggle with are the consumer protection laws because there is a lot of froth. There are a lot of people who are buying it because of the perception that it's just going up. And at some point, it's just a bubble. And when the bubble gets popped, then everybody be like, oh my God, this is ridiculous. And look at, they try to find the people who made the most amount of money who they can shoot, right? And so that maybe that's where you get state AGs or whatever involved. And you know, I mean, I'm forecasting it, but I'm not encouraging it. I just think that, you know, it, with any bubble, there's sort of this period of introspection. What went wrong and who can we blame, right? I mean, it's always the case. You always want to blame somebody. I lost money. I got to blame somebody, right? So
right.
I think NFTs are due for that. And at some point, which is not to say that it's hard to paint with a broad brush. And some of the projects maybe are a little more, how should I say, irresponsible. And, you know, that's unfortunate. But I think ultimately there is going to be a very solid case for it. Maybe some of the froth has to cool a little bit. And so the people who are really serious about it can get to work and think about what value are these NFTs imparting? Like, you know, if it's a collectible, whatever it is, it shouldn't be just catering purely to Wall Street to flip it. Like you buy a baseball card. People today buying baseball cards because they don't even care. Like, who's this guy? He played baseball? What, he could be whatever. It's like, okay, can I flip it? But you know, to a true baseball collector, they value that. They use that as a way of connecting to the sport. It's meaningful to them to have that connection. Same thing with music artists. Same thing with paintings. It means something to you. It establishes this sort of personal aesthetic connection that transcends the speculative value. Doesn't mean it's not speculative. Doesn't mean that you don't hope that you can later on sell it for a profit. But fundamentally, you're buying it not because you think it's ugly, not because you hate the artist, not because you can't stand basketball. You're buying it because you have an interest in these areas and it's a way of further connecting to it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that there is some convergence between those folks that are collecting for passion and the folks that are going to financially do the best out of this, because those folks that have the taste, that have the curative ability, like the taste makers who discover artists early on, discover up-and-coming players, they now have the ability to buy into the future upside of those creators, those players, by, you know, buying the rookie cards, buying an NFT from an emerging artist who doesn't have a strong brand yet. And then as that artist does succeed, as that player does grow, then those NFTs should increase in value. And I think social tokens will achieve a similar thing as well by letting people speculate on the value to be created by an individual or group. And in turn, that should enable a little more meritocracy in the way that creators are discovered, right? Like the existing power structures within the creative arts, you know, are oftentimes concentrated in a few, you know, like big name influencers and brands, especially with record labels and the way that the whole industry works. But if we have a system where there is really a democratization of that discovery process, the way that these artists are discovered by a broad range of curators, of tastemakers, then we can really kind of break down some of those power structures as well. So it's fascinating.
I love that. That was fantastic. You know, I think about my daughter. She listened to Shawn Mendes. She was like, I think, in the double or early low triple digits for his listeners when he first was... Yeah. You know, wow. When we first came out, like she was really early and she's like, this guy is going to be great. And she can say, hey, I was an early Shawn Mendes fan. So she still has that affinity for him because it's like, hey, I was part of it. I was there just when nobody else knew him, I found him, right? Like that's exciting. But imagine if she had actually a token that sort of, you could call it commemorated it, that sort of showed that she could prove that, hey, I was there. Imagine if you had some token and it's like, Shawn Mendes, listener number 90 or something, or like I bought his token just when. I mean, that's, you know, it's amazing. Imagine what that brings. And for that, the people who do that, the value that they get out of it, they probably wouldn't even sell it. Maybe they sell it way out in the future. But for somebody who is there early, like it's on some level, it's like you could offer all that, but it's like, no, that's my number. That's me there when he started or she started out. So again, I love what you said. And it so connects with me because my daughter is like loves these finding, you know, being part of that early story. And it gives so much more. It gives so much more of the experience if she had something that kind of connected her with it. So I love that point. You can see I'm excited about it.
Yeah, that's a great example. Definitely, you know, those early fans are the real supporters, right? And to the artist, those fans are actually much more valuable than the ones that come later on. It's harder to go from 10 to 100 than it is from 100 to 1,000 and so on. So you can imagine, you know, systems and tokens and NFTs really enabling new talent to be discovered and to bootstrap themselves with support from the early fans rather than relying on the existing power structure. So yeah, it's transformative.
Yeah, no, excellent. That's phenomenal. So we talked a bit about this notion of content aggregators sorting content versus the current structure of platforms today. I think that was sort of the vision of the future, maybe the vision of Web 3.0. But do you want to kind of expand on that a little bit? There's a lot there. Don't worry, there's going to be a longer one. If you got the time.
Yeah. So my thinking on this has been influenced by the team at Zora and Jacob, the CEO there. And really what the vision of Zora Protocol is exactly this. It's that in the future, platforms will be built on top of content and not the other way around. Right now, if you are any kind of creator, you're uploading content to your TikTok, to your Instagram, to YouTube, and then that content is essentially, you know, owned and controlled by those platforms. And you have some ability to monetize through the platforms, but it's on their terms. And the difference that NFTs enable is that it enables people to create that content directly on the blockchain that is owned and controlled by them. So the creator controls the content. They decide who to sell it to or how to monetize it. And then in that context, the role of platforms, it shifts. It actually inverts. So platforms really will play the role then of curating, surfacing, aggregating all of that content for the benefit of the creator and their fans, rather than having the platform as the owner and the creators and fans as users. And this is, again, a profound shift.
And I think a lot of the platforms are already kind of investigating how to do that or variations of that. Are you familiar with any that you could share with us?
I think there's definitely a lot of platforms that are going to be challenged by this. I do think that some of the new platforms have a huge opportunity here against the incumbents. What they're obviously competing against is, you know, massive network effects of the existing social media platforms. But their advantage is that, you know, they can be from day one built on top of user content and not the other way around. I mean, it's really a massive unbundling that the incumbents would have to go through to kind of switch to this new model. And at the same time, like, it is a bit of a transformation on the part of both creators and consumers to actually, you know, to switch to this model. It comes back to a lot of the big question that people ask around NFTs. You know, why would I buy an NFT? I'll just right click save as, and okay, I own your JPEG now. And I think that, you know, once people overcome that initial skepticism, it's somewhat of a big leap to acknowledge that, okay, this digital thing is the original, right? This digital thing has value because it is scarce. But in some ways, it's similar to that leap that everyone has to make about why Bitcoin is valuable, right? It's digital, it's scarce, it's censorship resistance, et cetera. So all of those properties, you know, exist in NFTs as well. But with the key difference being that the NFT represents some valuable content, right? And so people can inherently understand the value of art, of creative output, of culture, much more easily, I think, than people tend to understand these 21 million Bitcoins. So that's the big leap. And I think that's why we're seeing this NFT boom, is that content, media, art are much easier to grok than intangible digital gold.
And so which platforms do you think are getting it right, or maybe have the most likelihood, the new platforms, of succeeding?
Honestly, it's at such an early stage that all the NFT platforms are doing a great job right now in terms of capturing new artists and content. But I think there's no clear winner yet about who's going to be the aggregator, who's going to build the social media layer on top of that content. So let's check back in 3 and 6 months, and I'm sure there'll be some front runners.
And so when you talk about some of the existing NFT platforms, I guess you're thinking OpenSea, Rarible, Super Rare,
maybe, exactly, yeah,
or some other ones. So, you know, all these platforms are generally creating a ongoing royalty revenue stream for the underlying artist, right? Or maybe not all of them, but the artist certainly has the ability to say, how much of a royalty do I want? They can, I guess it depends by platform, but I know a number of them allow the artist to select. And so what that means is when that NFT changes hands, certainly if it changes hands on the platform, they get a percentage. But I also know that, like, Rarible, for example, has a deal with OpenSea that if you buy something on Rarible and then you turn around and you post it on OpenSea and somebody buys it, that royalty also flows back. So this notion of royalties flowing back to the original creator, how does that get supported across platforms?
Yeah, so this is the exact reason that Zora protocol exists, that the royalty rights should be inherent in the token themselves. The royalty shouldn't depend on the platform honoring that obligation. So every NFT minted on Zora, and this is why Zora is unique amongst all these platforms, is that the market is in the token. The token and the bids on that token are the NFT itself. So every time that token changes hands, no matter which platform it's surfaced on, no matter how it's discovered, the royalty is paid to the creator. So in that case, the market is inherent in the NFT itself, and the platforms are just a discovery layer on top of that. So a Zora NFT can be sold anywhere, can be surfaced anywhere, but the royalties always programmatically flow back to the artist.
Let's say I buy something on Rarible and I post it to Super Rare, or maybe Nifty Gateway, would there have to be an arrangement between Rarible and Nifty Gateway regarding supporting it? Or if you support the royalty structure, is it generally applied irrespective of what platform it originated from?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm not sure that there is like a real standard yet. There's definitely some of these deals that you mentioned. But I think, again, that should be programmatic, right? That's the benefit of blockchains, is that we can actually enforce these rules without requiring a social consensus or a legal agreement on top. Like it should be inherent in the token.
Right. And what do you think about the recent tokenization of Jack Dorsey's tweet? Are we going to see more of the Twitter posts by celebs and what have you turning into NFTs? Is that a new trend? Or, I mean, is that sort of what you were talking about when you content aggregation? Is that sort of an extension of that?
Yeah, it's similar, but it's almost kind of the reverse, right? Like that NFT, it's a collectible, right? It's basically like Jack Dorsey has signed that tweet and you own that. And that's great. Like that's a very interesting collectible, but ultimately like Twitter owns that tweet, right? Let's be real. You know, there's no, you know, copyright. There's no, not even a license to you to own that tweet. So it's the same as a collectible. I think that's definitely an interesting experiment, but you know, again, it comes back to who is the original creator of that content. And so once we move into a world where people first mint their tokens, mint their content, and then they upload that content to a social media platform, that's when we really flip the ownership structure.
So you're also involved in Fair Launch Capital.
Yeah, we started Fair Launch Capital around August last year at kind of the height of DeFi summer, where we saw a lot of projects launch. A lot of them, you know, launched very quickly. They didn't have money to fund security audits. And we saw a few hacks. We saw a few vulnerabilities. But at the same time, we kind of saw this new emerging movement where instead of raising venture capital, instead of going through a process of having these large token holders dominate the supply and dominate the governance, we saw projects like YFI launch to their communities. And these communities then became the owners of the projects. And so this is actually another profound shift enabled by crypto, where you have the people who are building the project, the people who are using it, and the people who are owning it all being one. You can imagine that the Venn diagram of those three intersecting. You know, people have talked about this for a long time, like why don't Uber drivers have equity in Uber, the company, right? They're the ones doing the hard work. Why shouldn't they get some of the upside in this immense value they've created? So when we saw that crypto projects were doing this natively from day one, we realized we needed to support this. And the way we realized that we could support them was actually enabling them to launch and launch to their communities. So funding audits was the first thing that you know, was the immediate need, raising that cash to actually, you know, it's a decent amount, 50, 60, 100K to actually get to launch. So that was the initiative. And it continues in a few different forms, including some, you know, education, some guidance around like, what are the emerging best practices? How do you, you know, establish a fair distribution? And we've actually got some announcements coming up soon about a new round of funding for some new projects.
Excellent. You're kind of giving them the template and helping them out. I mean, the security audits are very important initially. I mean, it can be the death of a project if you don't get that right.
Yeah, totally. You know, it's interesting that we're seeing them as kind of necessary but not sufficient now. Even projects that have undergone rigorous audits, there's so many vectors. There are so many attack vectors, some different economic outcomes that are vulnerabilities if exploited in the right way. So technically the security was there, but at an economic level, there's other exploits. It's a huge challenge for DeFi right now.
For sure, for sure. I talked a little bit about Web 3.0. Could you maybe first start off by maybe introducing the concept of 3.0 to the listeners? And how do you see the tokenization, whether it's social tokens or NFT of projects, and how Web3.0 facilitates that?
Yeah, I'd say Web3 is a moving feast in terms of its definition. You know, we started out a few years ago with the idea that dApps would form the backbone of Web3, the idea that decentralized applications would replace centralized ones, that people would be able to custody their own funds and use them in different applications. Everything from what we see in DeFi to a decentralized web without relying on centralized, you know, revenue or advertising models. And I think that's changed a lot over the years. But I would definitely say that NFTs and social tokens have reinvigorated the concept of Web3, the idea that the content is user-owned and the internet is built on top of user-owned content rather than on top of platform-owned content. And social tokens and DAOs, you can curate and manage and move value around that content. And so I think we're at a revival for Web3 right now.
And do you think like companies like Brave are leading the charge on Web3, or are there players that are also similarly or more intriguing?
Yeah, I think Brave is a great example of early Web3. It's an amazing concept, and I think it continues to be a great product. It is definitely that kind of first wave, and I think the second wave we're about to see is probably going to be more impactful, at least in the short term.
Meaning trying to put the payment rails on it and facilitating social tokens, et cetera?
Yeah, exactly. People transacting in social tokens, people bidding on NFTs, people joining DAOs to collectively create NFTs and sharing that value. Broadly, just like people being recognized for the value that they contribute, for different forms of value, not just capital. So a lot of the time in DeFi, we saw that whales with you know, large pools of capital could really extract a lot of value by getting a lot of tokens early on. And this is something we try to address through Fair Launch Capital as well, that fairness of distribution. But I think one of the really empowering things about crypto is that it enables people to convert their labor into capital in much newer and more efficient ways. You know, you can see that early contributors to projects that get tokens, they get that upside. Artists can create NFTs that represent the conversion of their creative output into capital, which can appreciate. You can have builders of open source projects be rewarded directly for their contributions, right? Whether it's using the product, testing, helping other users, contributing code, building community, all these things that have been historically undervalued. We now have a chance to actually to fix that and to empower people to build in public together.
Excellent. So these days you're doing more work with Ideaco Labs, right?
Yeah. Ideaco Lab is a venture fund and we invest in early stage crypto projects. But our unique approach is that we are really hands-on, like very hands-on with every single team that we invest in. We're in there in Figma files, helping with the design. We're designing token distribution models. We're talking to users. And we're leveraging, you know, IDEO's 40 plus years of design history, working with some of the top companies in the Valley, and leveraging that knowledge, bringing that to crypto to help these builders think about their users and design for their users.
So we covered a lot. I feel like we could keep going, but then it becomes a very long podcast. Is there any question, anything you think I should have been touching a little more on that maybe I skimmed over?
Eric, this was awesome. I think we covered a lot of fun stuff, and you're right. We could probably talk for another hour, but in the interest of listeners, I think, yeah, it was great to chat and cover a lot of ground.
So if listeners want to find out more about you and what you're doing, where can they find you and your projects?
Yeah, the best place is on Twitter at Brahmanathan. And through that, I link to Medium posts and things that I write. And yeah, would always love to connect with people building new things in the space. So please, DMs are open. Hit me up.
Excellent. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Eric.